This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
I don't know about you, but one of my favorite classes in school was always American history, especially stories about the men who have sat in the Oval Office. It's been a while since we've had a history class here on T-Books, so let's go for it. 100 years after his inauguration, Woodrow Wilson still stands as one of the most influential figures of the 20th century and one of the most enigmatic.
He really invented the 20th century for the United States and in many ways the world.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the author of one of the most complete biographies of the man who, among other things, led the U.S. through World War I. Then we'll spend an academic minute finding out that size really does matter. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson as President of the United States. Now, after more than a decade of research and writing, Pulitzer Prize-winning author A. Scott Berg has written Wilson, the most personal and penetrating biography ever written about the 28th president. Wilson is a commanding and revealing portrait of one of America's most influential yet misunderstood presidents. The Best of Our Knowledge is Joe Donahue spoke to Berg about what drew him to write about Woodrow Wilson.
Well, actually, this goes back to my teenage years when I read a book on Wilson and became rather intrigued by him. And I was always sort of interested in the fact that he always seemed like a tragic idealist. And I could never really find a book that told me much about him as a man. Because he had such an academic life, there were so many books written on a very academic level. And I wanted to find out more about what made Woodrow Wilson tick. And because he really, I think, invented the 20th century for the United States and in many ways the world.
When you look at those early years, how impressive is his upbringing?
Well, I think his upbringing made a great impression upon him, he being the son and the grandson and great-grandson of Presbyterian ministers. So his life was infused not just with religion, but with a really deep sense of morality. And I think we see that coming out throughout Woodrow Wilson's life during his academic years as a real leader in higher education in this country, but certainly in his presidency on the national and international stages.
And taking on this particular president, I'm curious as to whether the portrait that we have of this stoic figure sometimes ever got in the way of what you were doing or challenged you in some way of finding out about this man?
Well, I think you've put your finger on the great challenge for me, in fact, and I still think most people, those who even know who Woodrow Wilson is, I think the first image that leaps to mind is the one you painted of the stoic or the very dour Scottish Presbyterian minister's son, you know? And that is not who he was. He was a deeply emotional, romantic, passionate man. And nobody has ever seen this side of him, this rather human side of him. And I think that really informed so much of what he did in his presidency, because he really had this emotionally turbulent presidency, both in his personal life and certainly what happened on the world stage.
Let's talk a little bit about that presidency in his first term, the New Freedom. Give us a sense of the New Freedom and how this very progressive agenda was advanced in this country.
Yes, the New Freedom was the nickname given to the Wilson program, which was largely an economic New Freedom. And that's what the program was basically about. There was a theme that runs throughout Wilson's life, even when he was a student at Princeton and then when he became the president of Princeton, which had to do with leveling the playing field. He felt that part of being an American was being able to achieve anything you wanted and that you should have the same advantages that any rich person had. So as a result of that, so many of the actions, so much of the legislation that he proposed for the New Freedom was toward that end of leveling the playing field. It really starts with his creating the Federal Reserve System, in fact, which was a way of taking some power away from a handful of East Coast banks and basically spreading economic influence around the rest of the country. But then the other things that come along, you know, involve the Federal Trade Commission, loans for agriculture and so forth, great educational boosts. All these things were very much on Wilson's mind and on his plate.
You think about, and you write about this in the book, about obviously World War One breaks out in Europe during his second year in office, and this is his rallying cry and re-election campaign for a long time of Wilson kept us out of war.
Exactly. And the irony, of course, is shortly after his re-election, he was urging the country to get into the war. Wilson really did try to keep us out of the war as long as possible, even though many Republicans were, Teddy Roosevelt, chief among them, was urging us to get into the war from the very beginning. You know, one has to remember, and I tried to paint this in my portrait of Wilson, that he grew up in the South during the Civil War. He saw the devastation of the South. He saw what war does. He saw how it destroys an economy, how it kills people, how it, you know, just tears lives apart. And so as a result of that, he really did everything he could. He dug every diplomatic channel he possibly could to keep us out of the war. And he was successful for 3 years. But finally, by 1917, the Germans had torpedoed so many ships that had gone down taking American lives. They had really turned their backs on Wilson's repeated diplomatic efforts so many times that it really did behoove us to go to war. So you sort of see in 1916 into 1917, Wilson's rhetoric is changing, and he's really urging the country to mobilize, not just in terms of building materiel, but also in our morale and getting us ready to go to war, such that by April of 1917, a month after his second inauguration, he appears before the United States Congress, and he gave one of the most important speeches, well, not just of his life, but really of the 20th century, in which he said, "The world must be made safe for democracy." And in so saying that, he really introduced a new moral component into American foreign policy that we observe to this day.
His 14 points, one of those points being the League of Nations, which was to be an international parliament intended to prevent the outbreak of any future wars. This was something he was unable to get through.
Unfortunately, he was unable to realize that. It was the 14th point, and it is the real reason Wilson led us into the war. He really believed World War One could have been the war to end all wars. He believed that had a League of Nations existed in 1914, when the first shots were fired in Europe, had a league existed, he believed they could have prevented that war from breaking out, that the leaders of the world could have all sat down at a table and hashed out their problems and come up with a diplomatic solution to things. So he came back to America after having been gone for 6 months. He, the president, this is just so hard to fathom today, that the president of the United States left the country for 6 months, went to Paris to negotiate the peace, and he returned where he had to face basically part of the Constitution, which says only the Senate has the power to ratify treaties. So even though Wilson had drawn up this rather magnificent document, which included a League of Nations, the Senate was the one who had to approve it. So Wilson really had his work cut out for him at that point because he returned to an extremely hostile Republican Senate.
I'm curious about the background. You mentioned his time as president of Princeton University. How does a president of a university become a national figure?
You've really asked the big question about Wilson's life, because Woodrow Wilson had the most meteoric rise in American history. Imagine, in late 1910, in October of 1910, he is still the president of a small all-male college in the middle of New Jersey. And within 2 years, in the election of 1912, he's elected president of the United States. And he did that in a unique fashion. No other president has done what Wilson did, and that is, he became president by becoming a public intellectual. He did it through his books. He did it through speeches on public policy and so forth. And in that period, he did become governor of New Jersey for a very short time. And what happened when he was governor of New Jersey was he had been handpicked by the Democratic machine in the most corrupt state in the Union. And he made no promises to that machine, but once he became governor of New Jersey, he kicked the machine out. He utterly dismantled them. And now everybody in the United States was turning toward New Jersey and saying, who is this man who broke the New Jersey machine? I mean, that was just extraordinary. So he did it with a combination of his public intellectualism and really sharp elbows as a politician.
Did his time as a student at Princeton ultimately help him as president?
I think there's no question that his Princeton years helped him as president, because early on he became a student not just of American history, but really of American politics. And shortly after he graduated, he studied law, and then he also got a PhD in political science. He's our only president with a doctorate degree. And Wilson wrote a dozen books, most of them on either American history or on political science. You know, political science was a brand new area at the end of the 19th century, and Wilson became one of the very first practitioners of it.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with A. Scott Berg about his new biography of Woodrow Wilson continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1201. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author A. Scott Berg, who is talking to The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new biography of Woodrow Wilson, the 28th President of the United States.
You spoke a few moments ago about the tribulations of his time as president, both professionally and personally. We've spoken, of course, about many of the things that happened politically. Personally, the death of his first wife, Ellen, during his first term in office. What effect did that ultimately have on him, do you think?
Well, it was quite devastating on him. And in fact, this was one of the things I tried to bring out in my book, is what a romantic and passionate figure he was. There are thousands of love letters between him and his wife, Ellen, while he was courting her, and even during their marriage, when he often traveled to give speeches or to teach at other colleges and so forth. And they were so joined, they were so married, and here she is in the White House little more than a year, and she dies of kidney failure. And he was distraught. There was a period where he could barely get out of bed. And it was only this very strong Presbyterian sense of duty that got him to carry on. So that had a very deep effect. And then, within the course of the next year, he met a young widow in Washington, D.C., whom he rather privately courted and then married her. And this, you know, in some ways changed history too.
Because this was something that was not seen and was not often accepted of being remarried so quickly.
Exactly right. I mean, all his political advisors said, oh, you can't do this, Mr. President. I mean, this will have a devastating effect on you politically. You'll never get reelected if you do this. And it was almost like the Duke of Windsor, you know. I mean, he really did it to marry the woman he loved. And so he did. And of course, it had no political effect. And it's quite ironic because she was not an especially educated woman, and she certainly was not political. But Wilson, almost from the very first day they married, began to include him in all the work he was doing. He shared his memoranda with her. He began to even bring her to certain political meetings as though he's trying to educate her for something. And the irony is that later on in the administration, he would suffer from a stroke. And in some ways, Mrs. Wilson, the second Mrs. Wilson, Edith, would become the first female president of the United States.
You do talk about the rumors of him having an affair during his first marriage.
I do talk about that because they were much talked about in Wilson's day. There were these rumors of his having met a woman in Bermuda, where he used to vacation, back when he was still a college president. He knew this woman through the rest of his life. I came to discover that the affair actually did not exist, that it was a very deep friendship, although I think it was a little like President Jimmy Carter talking about lust in one's heart. I think there was that occasion of sin in Woodrow Wilson's life, in which I think there was not a physical affair, but there certainly was, for a moment, an emotional affair. And it had some effect on his marriage. Mrs. Wilson, the first Mrs. Wilson, said it was the only sadness in their marriage, but she believed that there had not been an actual affair. And it was sort of interesting when, you know, there were so many rumors about it. But Teddy Roosevelt, who ran against Wilson, said, we don't even want to talk about this affair because it only makes Wilson sound more interesting than Teddy Roosevelt thought he actually was.
There's so many fascinating aspects to his life and to his career. And one of the ones I found in the book to be most fascinating was his friendship and his ultimate dependence on Louis Brandeis.
Brandeis really is a fascinating figure, not just in American history, but as you point out, certainly in the life of Woodrow Wilson. He was largely the architect of the New Freedom. Before Wilson ran for the presidency, Louis Brandeis, who was called the people's lawyer, really was a big part of Wilson's thinking and spent a lot of time with Wilson. And then, of course, Wilson put Brandeis on the Supreme Court, which was a very bold move because Louis Brandeis was the first Jew to be appointed to the court. And this was very difficult. This was really almost something of a scandal, and really the first public hearing on a Supreme Court nominee was Brandeis's, and you could see that it dragged on for so long, largely because of anti-Semitism and little more.
It was his second court pick. Was he concerned about it the first time around?
Wilson would have liked to have appointed him that first time around, and there were so many other things going on. I think he felt it's not a fight I can afford to fight right now.
I do, as we wrap up, I do want to mention the op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times recently. You draw parallels between the Wilson presidency and the presidency of Barack Obama. What parallels do you see?
Well, I see a number of them, both personally and professionally. The personal parallels are here are two highly intellectual presidents who have written a lot. They are both constitutional scholars. Both Obama and Wilson were considered sort of cool and aloof. What I try to point out also, however, is that Wilson and Obama are quite different. I don't think Obama uses all the political tools that Wilson did. And the point of my op-ed was to recommend that he do exactly that, that he have more sustained dialogue between the White House and the Congress. Woodrow Wilson believed that the executive branch and the legislative branch should cooperate. And I mean that quite literally, that they should cooperate the government. And so as a result of that, Wilson became the first one to go back to Congress to deliver State of the Union addresses in person, which presidents hadn't done for over 100 years. He called joint sessions of Congress all the time whenever he had an important measure. And he sat in a little room in the Congress called the President's Room, which is just a small room with a desk and a few chairs where the president could basically lobby. He could twist arms. He could grab senators as they were walking off of the Senate floor. The whole point of my op-ed was to encourage Obama to do just that, to rip a page out of the Wilson playbook.
Again, the name of A. Scott Berg's new book is simply Wilson. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. If evolution has taught us anything, it's this. Size really does matter. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Many mammalian species have evolved into extraordinary size over the past 60 million years. Jordan Oakey, postdoctoral fellow in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, outlines a theory of why some species have grown so large.
The diversity of life is largely a matter of body size, which can vary by over 24 orders of magnitude in mass. To put this in perspective, the Earth is almost 23 orders of magnitude larger than an adult human. My research seeks to understand the underlying laws that govern the evolution and ecology of this diversity. Specifically, what factors influence the rate of evolution of body size, and what influences the maximum body size evolved by a lineage? Collaborating with other scientists, I developed a new quantitative theory from the observation that some organisms live fast and die young, while others take their time and mature much more slowly. Since larger organisms tend to live longer than smaller organisms, much of the diversity among species can be attributed to body size. But we show that once these effects are accounted for, important residual variation remains. The variation along this continuum reflects differences in the lifestyles and ecological niches of species. The theory demonstrates that lineages at the fast end of this continuum can more quickly evolve larger sizes and can evolve larger maximum sizes than lineages at the slow end. Our theory was well supported by data culled from fossil records of mammals over the last 70 million years. The groups of mammals at the fast end of the lifestyle continuum, such as whales, evolve larger maximum body sizes. They also evolve these maximum sizes more quickly than groups at the slow end, such as primates. By uncovering a new law of nature, this work provides insight into patterns of recovery from mass extinction events and the potential for modern species to adapt to climate change.
That was Jordan Oakey of Arizona State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.